Welcome to another episode of Residentially Speaking, a podcast dedicated to bringing you interesting and informative content from key builders, dealers, thought leaders, and influencers across the residential construction industry. I'm your host, Alan Hubble.
AI is a big term that covers a lot of different segments, but the momentum we've seen most notably recently is out of the large language models. And that's been the hype, that's the ChatGPTs of the world, where the generative AI, which is a subset of AI, has actually been around for a while. So what I think of that home building, for sale or for rent, and I think of large language models, I have to ask myself, well, yes, words are necessary to some components of housing, but it's not going to build a house for me, right? Maybe that's robotics, right? That's not AI. So I think AI will be helpful, but I'm not sure that it's going to be disruptive or transformative to the housing industry necessarily.
Joining us on today's podcast is Devin Bachman, Chief Operating Officer of John Burns Real Estate Consulting, or JBRAC. Devin has been with JBRAC about 9 years now, having progressed through a series of jobs with them, series of positions, and you will find her to be an absolute wealth of knowledge on the residential construction industry. She knows her information, she knows her analyses, she knows her customers, she knows her markets, and it's really a pleasure to talk with her. I would encourage anybody who isn't familiar with John Burns to check them out. And Devin's also a great communicator. She makes the difficult things simple, as you'll hear in our discussion, and which we take a trip around the residential construction industry, as well as a brief discussion around AI or artificial intelligence in the construction industry. So we're very happy that she was generous with her time and able to join us for this discussion. And we hope you enjoy the podcast. Thanks. Residentially Speaking, that's coming up. Devin Bachman, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you.
Thanks, Alan. It's a pleasure being here. I appreciate you guys thinking of me.
Oh, awesome. Always. Now, you guys are great. So, Devin, you've been at JBRAC 8 or 9 years now, maybe 9 or so.
Yeah, it'll be 9 in October.
Wow. Awesome. And I've probably known you for maybe 6 or 7 of those. I think we met early on in your time there. Tell us a little bit about yourself and about maybe how you landed. Bring us up to the John Burns time. We'll talk about that next, but how you landed in the construction industry.
Okay, perfect. So I am a Denver native, raised in Colorado my whole life, made the very bold move to go from suburban Denver to Boulder for school. Go Buffs. Studied business administration with an emphasis in marketing and a minor in real estate. So I'm literally doing exactly what I went to school for, which I know many of us these days aren't. But I guess I could say I knew my passions at an early point in time. And I know you asked specifically how I got in the construction industry. And it was really an internship during college that I did, specifically in commercial real estate, that just opened my eyes to the world of real estate. It was dynamic. It was exciting. It was a different day every day. And I said, oh, wow. This is something I want to be a part of. And I think for those of you who are listening, who are in a position to offer internships, please do. I know we do them at JBRAC, but it changed my career trajectory. And I know it can be a powerful tool for other young people out there.
That's cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
So you are using your degree. You're right. That's not always the case with folks. That's great.
Yeah. And at that time, I was graduating from school and my now husband and I were relocating to the great state of Texas. And it was the year 2011. And for those of you who remember 2011, it was coming right out of the great financial crisis. So, and I was moving to Texas, a market where I didn't know many people. So I had to knock on a lot of doors, write a lot of emails in order to get my first role in housing. But I was so glad to accept a role with Pulte Group, who is a publicly traded home builder. And I started there as a market intelligence analyst, actually on the climate side, like you, Alan, consuming a lot of the research and information that JBRAC put.
Oh, very cool. And that was in Dallas, you said?
I was in Dallas. Yep, Dallas, Texas. Dallas. And I spent 3 years there at Pulte. And it was a great jumping off point to learn the industry, to learn home building. I spent a lot of time looking at land, trying to understand what kind of home we would build on that land. How should we price it? What is the consumer we should target? And it was a really strong foundation for learning home building as an industry.
Yeah, that's cool. Was JBRAC Burns part of the information coming in?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was. So it was a great to get to use it from the client side. And now hopefully being on the firm side, I'm stronger because I've seen both sides.
Yeah, that's great. I guess, so you've had the client side, and then at some point you made the decision then to move over to JBRAC, to John Burns.
Yeah, I did. And there was a crazy personal side to my story, which is that, growing up, they tell you, marry a professional athlete. Your life is going to be so exciting and dynamic. And what they don't tell you is that you have to move all the time.
Right.
So I did that. I married a professional hockey player, and we were currently relocating from Dallas and then Oklahoma to upstate New York, and Pulte doesn't build homes there. So I needed to look for my next step. Yeah. I actually thought I was going back to grad school. I'd studied for the GMAT, spent 1,000 hours, took the test, did the whole thing, and then the phone rang. And this is the power of relationships. So it was actually the woman I had worked for at Pulte who had just joined the John Burns team. And she said, we're hiring for a remote analyst. I think you should consider JBRAC.
Really?
And I did. And I am so happy that I took that phone call and the offer to look for that opportunity.
Oh, cool. I think that's where I think you were living in New York when I met you in Buffalo.
You were.
Buffalo.
Utica. It's upstate. Yeah. It's not too far from Buffalo, a couple hours away, but yes.
Okay. And then obviously, I mean, you've progressed very well, senior leader at JBRAC, at John Burns now. And so position of COO, chief operating officer. And so I noticed in your profile, you had, let's see, research, consulting, and operations. That's kind of the scope of your responsibility or the areas you tend to play in. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I oversee the day-to-day operations of our research, our consulting, and our business operation verticals. So I help them troubleshoot the day-to-day as well as execute long-term growth strategies for all of those verticals. But Alan, I didn't come in starting doing that. I came in as a research analyst with a specialty in qualitative-based research, which is survey work, with a passion for ops on the side. And over the years, really realized that operations was where my true passion lied and was lucky enough to be offered the position that I'm in today.
Okay, great. And then you've made at least one move, I think, right? You're now in Iowa.
Yep. We did a stint in Colorado during COVID, but yes, now we're in Des Moines.
Okay. And just because it's such an interesting field, your husband is still playing or not playing? He's still involved in the NHL?
Yeah, he is not playing any longer. He did retire 4 seasons ago. And, I said, congratulations on your amazing career. We don't have to move anymore yet. No, just kidding. He did have a wonderful career. And that's when the Minnesota Wild and us began a conversation that would evolve into what he has today, which is coaching their minor league goalies.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
It is. It's fun. It's a whole other part of my life that is equally enjoyable to what I do at JBRAC.
Yeah. I mean, so you've gotten to travel around and see some cool places and of course with your job as well, right?
Yeah. And meet some really amazing people.
Let's switch gears a little bit to another topic that's kind of dynamic in society in general, right? But let's talk about how it might be applied in the construction industry. And you and I got to talk about this a month or two ago earlier in the summer on a panel that you hosted around artificial intelligence and construction. So it's kind of get to turn the tables a little bit here and ask you some questions. AI in construction, who's using it? What are you seeing? What are you hearing from your clients in terms of how it might impact things?
Yeah, I'll start first from like an industry perspective, Alan. I'm going to first start this with a caveat, which is this is all moving so fast. I'm not an AI expert. So give me the ability to revise myself. In fact, by the time that this podcast is published, I don't know what your publishing time is, 15 to 30 days from now, we could be living in a different AI world.
Right.
So that's the kind of speed we're talking about. I would say AI is a big term that covers a lot of different segments, and we can talk about some of those today. But the momentum we've seen most notably recently is out of the large language models. And that's been the hype. That's the ChatGPTs of the world, where the generative AI, which is a subset of AI, has actually been around for a while. So what I think of that home building, for sale or for rent, and I think of large language models, I have to ask myself, well, yes, words are necessary to some components of housing, but it's not going to build a house for me, right? Maybe that's robotics. Right. That's not AI. So I think AI will be helpful, but I'm not sure that it's going to be disruptive or transformative to the housing industry necessarily. And I think it's important to know that it has limitations. And that's part of what plays into that comment by me. It's not good at math. It often hallucinates. You have to literally check it because it will make things up. You need to have a closed network solution. So you're not dumping your proprietary data into the Internet of Things for other people to learn from. And if you're going to do it right, you need somebody with technical skills to build useful products and proprietary tools. It's not that easy to just riff from. So I'm not sure it'll take the jobs of anybody in this industry anytime soon. Might take jobs of people who don't know how to use AI to make themselves faster and automate certain tasks. But I think it'll be a net benefit, but not, again, disruptive or transformative.
Yeah. So can I read into that then? So clients aren't necessarily driving hard for solutions from you or positions or studies or research, so forth, around integrating AI into their operations or into the work that they do? Or
I can't say that and maybe if there's a builder out there and I haven't talked to you and you're using it really well, hey, contact me after this and I want to hear about how you're using AI. I'm actually seeing most of the momentum, like our other panelists on the panel we were on together, Alan, they're actually outside solutions providers to the industry. So this would be people who play in machine learning, which is pattern recognition. So, hey, can I take all of the purchasing data? Can I recognize the pattern of what consumers are selecting? And can we optimize that so that our incentive package is optimized from both a margin perspective, but also from a consumer preference perspective? Another outside solution provider I've seen is computer vision, which is another subset of AI. This is where we see those who are offering, hey, I'm going to look at your site plan and I'm going to recommend what kind of lots you should have based on the topography, based on any easements or what kind of roads you're going to be putting in place or parks, et cetera. And then last but certainly not least, the natural language processing, which we've already talked about a little bit here with the LLMs, which would be chatbots or things that will help you, I want to go through all my maintenance requests and see if there's a trend and there's a way that I could improve a process. You can do that through the natural language processing mechanism. But I can't say that I've seen a builder do anything disruptive today. It might just be too early, Alan, to see that. It's more those outside the industry providing tools to make the industry faster and more efficient.
Yeah, fair enough. I know we've used it some in some marketing applications, content creation, and with a variety of experiences, right?
Right.
I'm not an expert either. I know enough to be dangerous. What I do know that you have to get really good at writing your prompts and how you're asking the question. That's absolutely critical to the answers you get back. But I fully agree with you. I think you've nailed it in terms of where it might be used and how. But by the time we post this, maybe the world's changed.
Maybe it has. And prompt engineers are now, that's a job, right? A year or two ago, that wasn't a job. It's also really good at JD's job descriptions. If you're listening to this podcast and you haven't used it for a JD, you are 6 months behind the rest of the world. Please check that out. It is actually very good at giving you ideas for your job descriptions.
Yeah, right. I know my wife has a small business and I've used it to help on some of the content creation. I'm her marketing person. I'm her
There you go.
Person.
I love that, Alan.
I'm her truck driver. I'm her laborer. I'm everything. But I'm also her AI user, so. Yeah, great. Yeah, any other comments on AI? You probably covered it well there.
Yeah, I would say inside of JBREC would be my only other comment. Like, what are we doing today? And I would say we're really in the early stages too of figuring out how we're going to most effectively use it. But I will say that AI supercharges companies like ours that have large amounts of proprietary data and analysis. And so we're going to try to harness that power and use the language models to enhance the velocity and the digestibility of our research. And I think those LLMs play really well into the industry we're in, maybe not as directly into home building. And we're hoping to introduce tools in the future to our clients with AI functionality.
That's cool. Look forward to that. Yeah, I had also heard a podcast recently where it was a business professor at one of the more well-known business schools, talking about how they would give their students a project that might take all semester, and they're noticing they're finishing them so much faster. They're coming back in 3 weeks, 4 weeks, what used to take 3 or 4 months. And it's the use of the AI tools that is driving the speed, the velocity.
Yeah. And that back to my comments earlier, Alan, I don't think it's going to take jobs, but I think it'll take the jobs of the people who don't learn how to use it, because it does make you that much more efficient, that much more effective, and automate just a myriad of manual tasks that, Alan, I don't want to do them either, and I guarantee you don't.
Right. That's right. Well, cool. So let's turn a little bit to construction this year, 2024. It's such a dynamic year, it feels like so much going on. Well, certainly the last 4 years, right? Ever since COVID has been up, down, all around, coming off high, crazy highs. We haven't hit the lows, but we're starting to see kind of a normalization, maybe you'd call it, of the market. Maybe I'm hearing words like seasonality is returning. Can you give us some color, like a high level, just in terms of where 2024, what have we seen? And maybe let's hold off on maybe where we're going, but how would you describe the market maybe today?
Okay, well, I think we should start with mortgage rates because that's really the backbone of the housing industry. So I'd like us to start the conversation there, which the Fed funds futures market had been calling for some time for a cut in September. And then Jerome Powell actually spoke this morning. And he said that the upside risks to inflation have diminished and the downside risks to employment have increased. So I think we're looking at the cuts coming here. And he indicated that basically in his presentation this morning. And, you know, the Fed has a tough thing to do. They're trying to thread that proverbial needle, right, Alan, yeah, of the yeah. soft landing. And today's comments reaffirmed that they're liking what they're seeing, but I think they're really being careful not to tip those scales, right? We have a cooling jobs market. Unemployment just ticked up. It's now at 4.3%. They like what they're seeing out of CPI at 2.9%, but it's still above that 2% target. So I think we're going to see an easing in rates. We're not going to go back to the COVID craziness, low pandemonium. Sure. But I do think that will help the housing market over the next few years. We've actually done a lot of consumer research, and the 5.5, you've maybe even read some of this, the 5.5% in mortgage rate is that sweet spot for consumers. So if we can get anywhere near that, I really think that's going to be a big benefit to housing.
Yeah. And today we're where? 6.5?
Yeah.
Right.
I didn't check the numbers this morning, so I don't want to be misquoted, but I'll take your word for it, Alan.
Sure. Okay. Somewhere in there. Plus or minus.
We'll have the plus or minus.
And so you mentioned the inflation index, is that PCI?
CPI.
CPI. Can you talk a little bit about just how housing is a component of that? It's a right. kind of a key component, right?
Right.
But it's a weird measure, right? It's this lagged rent, some rent equivalent thing. Can you talk just a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a great question and a topic I don't think often gets enough airtime, Alan. So if you look at the breakout of the components of inflation today, housing is the largest driver. Now, it's not necessarily the largest share of CPI, but it's the largest driver, being that it still has kind of inflationary power behind it. Now, when you actually look at housing as a component of CPI, owner's equivalent of rent is the largest share of that portion of housing. And the way the Fed looks at it is actually like a backward-looking measure of a number of months. Now, they are already they're seeing the deceleration in rents that for a while, you look at our data and others out there, we were saying, hey, this has been happening for a while. They're seeing that in the numbers. We're actually starting to see the rental market start to come off the bottom and show modest growth, which technically isn't showing in the Fed's numbers today. So there's maybe a little more inflationary pressure for housing in the system that the Fed's not even picking up.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we'll come back to that. So maybe there's some signs of life for multifamily. Is that what that's
You know what? I think
bit?
There is. And I think there's a couple factors at play. But when we talk about multifamily, I'll share more on it.
Okay. And then so where do you want to go next? Maybe demand? For those of us in the industry, I think we know long term, we know we have a housing shortage. We know we have an affordability issue, obviously, but it's like the wind is at our backs for, I think, a long time. We may have some ups and downs in over time, but generally pretty positive on the long-term trend for housing.
Yeah, I think so, Alan. And there's a number of reasons why I would agree with you. The first being work from home is not going away. I know we've beat the dead horse on that topic, so I won't go over it too much. But what I don't think is getting enough airtime today is that not only is it here, it's actually growing. So today, about 35.7 million people work at least one day from home. That rose by 5 million people year over year.
Really?
This year. So what does that mean? It means people can live further out. What type of housing is further out usually? New construction. So I think that is a massive bonus for new construction. And we've already proven resale homes are not set up to work well oftentimes for that work from home setup where new construction is really catering to that marketplace. So I still think, even though we've been talking about work from home for years now, it's still a massive driver of demand. Another driver, Alan, I think is the massive population growth that we have seen last year and then coming into this year. Now, it was the numbers we're looking at are about a 3.8 million person growth in 2023. And we're thinking just over 4 million for 2024. Those are record levels of population growth. All those people are going to need somewhere to live. Now, they typically are renters before they're homeowners. So I think I might argue that that's a boon for rentership before home ownership. And you might be saying, well, Devin, where are all these people coming from? And a huge portion of it is immigration. And a huge portion of that immigration is still legal status pending. Now, there are a few laws passed just this year that are going to curb that. And we actually think we're going to see a modest, more return to normal population growth. But those are still massive tailwinds for housing when you look at those numbers.
Yeah. And I know that I know you all have, John, when I had John on the podcast a couple few years ago, we talked at length around the book, the major trends coming at us, and demographics obviously is huge. And I know you all have recently updated some of his work as well. Mm-hmm. Have you, and is it, I think during COVID, didn't the birth and death rates come down pretty close together? And now, so you're starting to see them, you're starting to see some additive, I guess, is the way to say it, add to the population, like you're saying.
Yeah, and the additive is coming through immigration. So the closing of the births and deaths is not where we're getting the net population growth. It's from immigration that boon. And you bring up what I was actually going to bring up already next, Alan, like you knew where I was going, which is the housing undersupply. That is still, John and you probably talked about it a few years ago on the podcast, and it's still very much a story. But I have updated numbers for you today because we're checking on this analysis as part of our new demographics package every single month. And today, the numbers that we believe hold to be true are that the U.S. housing market is undersupplied by about 1.4 million units today. That's roughly 600,000 on the for sale side and 800,000 on the for rent side. And then based on underlying demographics, and, you know, we can trend those forward. That's the one thing about demographics, right? You know that I will be 10 years older at some point and my generation will be that much bigger. We think that we need about 1.79 new homes. And when I say new homes, that can be for sale or for rent per year, 2033. So that's 1.65 million completely new, and then 140K. And then the completely new is to keep up with the growth of population. And then that additional 140K is the makeup for how short we already are today. So what I'm telling you, and kind of summary there, Alan, is we need more housing units. And that is something that's going to be a boon for housing for a long time to come.
Yeah. Okay. And how about, I'll put you on the spot here. And I don't know if you know this number or not or can recall it. I'm sure you can. There's like a certain amount of, this always fascinates me, there's a certain number of housing that's just torn down every year, right? It's old. It's just, you can't live in it. I mean, it's a small number, but it's still.
Yes. It's still, tear downs are part of it, but also second homes are a part of it too.
Oh, okay.
So something we haven't talked about from a demand perspective too, is we're seeing this very much bifurcated economy, the haves, what I'll call the haves and the have not, where this haves economy, it's why we hear about luxury good outperformance still today. Or luxury housing, et cetera. So there's that demand for the second home, which is going to be part of this haves economy, that again, I think is that boon for housing, because typically new housing, especially for sale, going to be more expensive than resale.
Yeah. So let's talk about affordability. That is a big problem, right?
It is.
It's a big problem. I know we do some work in Canada. It's a major problem in Canada. It's a problem here. What are we looking at? How do we solve that? How do we address that? So you could say build more, I guess, right? Introduce more supply, and there's issues there. But what do you have to say around, what are your thoughts around affordability?
Yeah, I would argue, yes, the undersupply that we just talked about is a contributing factor to the affordability situation that we're in today. But it also is the state and local municipalities and their requirements and the regulation around housing. They say they want it, and then they pile on fees and requirements on requirements, and you need the slope or pitch of your roof to be a certain set. They want gables on the house. They want wooden shutters, and it's like, those things don't come for free. They're expensive, right? We want all of the homes to be on large lots. Well, that's expensive. So I think we have to see some massive reform in our municipalities and the requirements in the regulation to really help from an affordability standpoint, because the builders would love to build more affordable product. And in some areas and locations, it's just not able to allow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a challenge. I have a 28-year-old daughter, and I just think about how is she ever going to be able to afford something without maybe some help from mom and dad. But
Right, which is part of that haves economy, right? The wealth,
right.
The wealth transfer and what that's going to do to the next generation, it's just going to continue that bifurcation because maybe that parent is going to support that. And that just further creates and perpetuates that bifurcation.
Yeah. So speaking of bifurcation, single family and multifamily behaving in very different ways.
Yes.
Year to date, at least I look at the numbers. And so what do you say about the two of them? And then maybe let's dive into single family a little bit.
Okay. So new construction, single family new construction started the year stronger than I think I was even expecting it to. When you look at our home builder survey and the rate of new home sales per community, you mentioned seasonal averages. The builders were selling about 38% above seasonal average January. And I was like, wow. Okay, if January was that strong, this spring is going to be hot tamales.
Yeah.
And then, Alan, it wasn't. And it wasn't that it was disappointing. I think the builders were still very happy with spring. It slowly tapered throughout the spring season. Okay, the sales were good. All right, they were okay. All right, I got to use a little more incentives. All right, I had to use incentives on all my sales. So the builders are still meeting sales expectations, but as of this month, which we only have data through July, right? Because August is not available yet. Sales averages are now at seasonal average. So we went from being 38% above seasonal average in January to just being at seasonal average today. So they've normalized. I think when you look forward, I know you mentioned earlier, you know, not just now, but what are we looking forward to in 24 and 25? I think new construction is maybe slightly up next year. And it's still the proliferation of the mortgage rate buy down, right? That continue, even if rates come down a little bit, it's still a huge net benefit to new construction. But resale inventory is on the rise. Resale inventory today is up 19% year over year. And I know it's, you know, much of the benefit of new construction besides the mortgage rate buy downs is that a lot of the resale inventory needs repair. It's a little bit older, it's vintage, et cetera. But it's going to be more competition for the new home than they've really seen for a while because supply was so low.
Yeah.
And even if you look in certain pockets of the country, Alan, they're above 2019 levels.
In terms of
resale inventory.
Resale inventory, yeah. I mean, it's off a small base, right? But or a smaller base, never smaller.
Yeah, yeah. And so there are some markets that even you take COVID out of the equation and they're above that. So, yeah.
And so obviously I would think that tends to dampen. So what effect, as resale inventory rises, what does that do to the builder? They may slow their builds because they're not quite sure. They don't want to be stuck with inventory. So there's a whole interplay there, right?
Yeah, it's a competition, right? So it creates more competition for the new home market where supply was so low and the mortgage rate buy down was so attractive, right? Because rates had become ultra elevated that it really created this huge competitive advantage for new construction where I think that a competitive advantage is shrinking. I still think we've had a strong year in single family this year. When you look at it on net basis so far, I think we see modest growth into next year, which is great. I don't think in a time where we're going to see robust growth out of the new construction market over the next few years.
Yeah, fair. And do you see the national builders anyway? So is it only national builders offering rate buy downs, or if you're a large regional builder, I'm not sure I've ever seen that. What does your research show?
Yeah, so it's those who have a lending partner that's captive or a partnership with a lending partner who can offer the rate buy down because it's actually offered as part of your mortgage that is able to happen. So if you are a smaller private and you don't have a captive mortgage arm, you're likely unable to offer those unless you have a partner maybe that's offering them, but still those are going to be more.
Gotcha.
Or rare. So the big are going to get bigger. And they have, Alan, over the last few years because of attractive tools like the rate buy down.
Yeah. I was at a builder event a week or so ago. And the question was asked, how long will you continue to offer the rate buy downs? And of course, there wasn't a hard and fast rule. The answer was, what I heard was, as long as we need to.
That is what you're hearing? I've heard the same sentiment, Alan, as long as we need to. You also have to remember the builders still have outsized margins. So if you go back and look at the Publix in comparison to where they were historically pre-COVID, now these mortgage rate buy-downs, they're expensive and they they cost hundreds of basis points in margin, but because their margins are still outsized, they have that wiggle room to offer these buy-downs.
So if I was king for a day, rates come down, they stop offering the buy-downs, and the building product guys get to raise prices and take some of that margin to their side of the table. Maybe? I don't know.
Maybe. You
know,
we'll see.
I know. Your clients are on both sides of it. So.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's a great point. Their margins are up since COVID, and it's going to be interesting to see. And like you said, I guess the 5.5% kind of magic rate, maybe things start to cool down or slow down there. Are these rate, I know there's different ways to do the rate buy-downs. Are folks offering mostly like a 3-year ARM, a 5-year rate buy-down, a 30-year rate buy-down? What are they offering?
Alan, we've surveyed on it before, and it's really a mixture. I mean, obviously, if I'm the consumer, especially on the entry level, Alan, they're saying the only way I'm getting in from it, back to the affordability conversation, the only way I'm getting in is if you do a 30-year full-term buy-down, because I just can't afford to get in any other way. Okay. But I think when you look at other spectrums of the market, you have the full 30-year buy-down. I'm seeing 3-2-1s. I'm seeing 2-1s out there still, which means, you know, the rate is bought down for a certain period of time. And then over time, that rate does increase. I've gotten a lot of questions like, oh, no, that sounds like an adjustable rate mortgage. And that got us in a lot of trouble not very long ago. The difference is, thanks to Dodd-Frank, now the buyer has to qualify for the highest rate in that mortgage's history. So even though they're getting the lower teaser rate today, they actually have to qualify at what will be the highest rate in that mortgage's tenure. So we're not afraid of default like we would be with the ARM.
Yeah. Okay. That was going to be my follow-up. So, okay.
Read your mind.
Yeah. So they have to, okay. So they have to qualify at that higher. That's good. That's good for the industry.
That is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So that's single family. That's encouraging. We also, at least for DuPont, part of our sales also go into multifamily. We're actually, our mix, we sell a little bit higher value product there. We have a little bit higher attachment with some of our accessories. So our mix is about what the mix is for starts. So that total starts number is kind of a good number for us.
Yeah.
But we're feeling it in multifamily for sure, right? 30%, roughly a third of the starts or so, and down pretty significantly.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Yeah. I will start with maybe being a little optimistic, which is counter to, I think, where I would have been at the start of this year, Alan, and say that Alan, apartment demand has held up better than any of us expected it to, despite that overwhelming amount of supply. So, you know, you would have asked me January 1, and I was like, there is a pig in the python in this multifamily supply coming down. It's going to be a lot to work through. And maybe it was more of like a piglet than a pig, because the market worked through it much faster than we expected it to. And you know what I think that's contributed to by is, A, it's more affordable. Rates blew out, and rental product in general is more affordable. But also, the point we already touched on, which is immigration and the massive population, because those people tend to be renters first. So we had this record population growth, and I think it helped the multifamily market. Now, don't get me wrong. We very much saw rents correct in a lot of the large markets. I would say rents are up modestly today, and we're going to see the most of the rent growth this year out of the Midwest and the coastal markets. Why? Because there wasn't quite as much supply. And so I think it's more muted there. But you're right. Permits have massively decelerated. We're down to about 515,000 when we look on like a seasonally adjusted annual basis, which is a pretty precipitous fall, which means starts are going to fall, which means there's probably some opportunity for demand to regulate itself as it's related to supply. And then I do think demand, hopefully, as rates, as the Fed pulls back the federal funds rate, we will see more deals getting done, because that's been the biggest headwind, Alan, but also a blessing in disguise, right? Because it pulled supply off, but deals just don't pencil today. So in summary, I think a client at one of our recent events that you might have even been at said it best when they said there is stress on the horizon, but not de-stress out there today in multifamily. And he asked me 6 months ago, and I might have reversed that statement. So I think there is going to be some minor recaps. There was some rent correction. We're working through the supply, but permits have fallen off. And I think a lower return on the federal funds rate will kind of slowly bring the multifamily market up to where it should be.
Okay. And I think I heard you all in one of your monthly webinars talk about, well, let me just say first, I know you all have investment, you work with investors as a client base. Mm-hmm. And so you're able to track some of that early money coming into the segment, right? Interest and so forth. And so I think I heard someone from JBRAC mentioned that there was starting to see maybe some more money coming into the site, which is a good sign, right?
Yeah, I think people are pleasantly surprised with where multifamily is at today and thought it would be in a whole lot worse shape than it is.
Yeah. So maybe you answer this, but I get the question internally, we'll say, you know, multifamily is down and maybe going to stay down for a while until things pencil a little bit better and we work through some oversupply in some markets. They say, well, how can that be? Like what was the number? You know, 1.8 million, 1.7 million undersupplied. But obviously one's a long-term horizon. You got to work through the short term to get to the long term, I guess.
You do. Right. And just because we're oversupplied today, that oversupply is very different by market. It's very different by price band. I gave you the numbers for for sale versus for rent. And we do cover in our research kind of differences by metro. We don't have enough time to talk about them all today, but maybe in the future, Alan, we can do a tour of the country and we can talk about all the large markets. But it all can't come at once. And the affordability challenges and the construction challenges, the municipality challenges, all of those are going to make it harder to catch up.
Okay. Yep. Makes sense. How about, and then I guess it's a subsegment of multifamily, would be built for rent. It's been a really hot segment. Right? Growing segment. What can you tell us about that today? Is it, I think long-term, I think I've heard you all say it's still positive, still looks good. Maybe we have some short-term bumps like in the rest of multifamily, but has it held up better than apartments, what do you call apartments or not?
It is trended very similarly to apartments from a rent growth perspective. Okay. When you look at occupancy, it's actually got a higher occupancy rate than multifamily through this bumpiness. I think it's here to stay. It is another type of housing that addresses the undersupply and the affordability challenges we were talking about. Yep. Also, there's more renters by choice in this country today than there ever have been. And this is a great option for that family renter who doesn't want to buy. But I do think there are some markets, I'm looking at you, Phoenix, where the supply pipeline has to be thought through. There's a lot of supply for specifically BTR or build to rent coming to that market. So I'm positive on build for rent as an asset class, and I'm maybe less optimistic on certain markets where the supply pipeline is massive, but I think you could argue that for multifamily as well. I think one other point on BTR is that a reason I'm optimistic is there's a lot of scrutiny on SFR today as it relates to policy, and BTR is net additive. You're not buying homes out of a market that someone else could theoretically live in. So the regulators are less concerned with it. They're not poking and prodding it quite the way that they are SFR. And I think that's a boon to BTR long term.
And SFR being?
Single family rental. And the way we define single family rental is a home that is not contiguous in nature with other rental homes. Yep. It is most likely coming from the resale market. Now, there are some new people will buy new homes and turn them into an SFR. It's not going to be professionally managed necessarily. It's maybe mom and pop. Remember, the majority of SFR today is mom and pop landlords. So it's similar, but distinctly different than BTR.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, but it's BTR, SFR, I guess, it gets complicated pretty fast, doesn't it?
It does. I always say it's really straightforward when you go to multifamily because someone lives above you or below you. It's professionally managed and it's contiguous in nature. BTR, same thing, but nobody has to live above or below you. You can be attached or detached. And then single family rental is kind of the rest of what we think of when it comes to rental housing.
Right. And I know for us as a building products manufacturer, we think about, is that builder going to build it? Is he going to operate it? Is he building it for somebody else? Did somebody else ask him? Yes. Is he going to sell it to an investor? Like there's all these
That's a whole nother when you get into the actual development side of it, different ways that you can categorize it.
Yeah. So wrapping up the market here, any long-term concerns in residential? What I'm thinking you're going to answer macro economy kind of stuff. But
you're guessing right, Alan, and I'll use an alliteration to sum it up for us here today. Recession risk, namely jobs, because people need to have a job in order to afford housing for sale or for rent. Rates, we spent a lot of time talking about that, and so you would know why I'd be concerned. And then the other one that I already harped on, so I won't again, is regulation. So recession risks, rates, and regulation. And if we don't solve for those, or we only solve for one, but not completely, we're probably stuck in this perpetual housing gridlock that just slowly moves forward, but doesn't allow for robust growth.
Great. Okay. Three R's. I'm going to use that. I can remember that.
All right.
Well, I think we'll close there. We appreciate the tour of the residential construction industry. It's always interesting talking to you and talking to the folks from JBREC, and can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast and talking with us.
Well, I appreciate you guys including me in your wonderful podcast series. It's been a pleasure, as it always is, Alan, and until next time.
All righty. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
This podcast is brought to you by DuPont Performance Building Solutions, who provides the marketplace with a full suite of weatherization, thermal, and air sealing solutions, such as DuPont Tyvek wraps, flashings, and tapes, DuPont Styrofoam brand XPS rigid foam board, and Great Stuff and Froth Pack spray foams. DuPont knows the homes you build today will need to stand the test of time, expanding, contracting, breathing, and protecting for generations to come. Be sure to check back often for new episodes. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Alan Hubble, and residentially speaking, that's a wrap.